Working.
Good.
Right, today I'm going to talk about the Tangle Hypothesis in some slightly higher low dimensions and attempt to go into some greater generality. So one of the features as you go up the dimensions is that the pictures very quickly become difficult to draw. And we already saw yesterday that it's quite complicated to decide what the coherence should be between the structure for the duals and the structure for the N category. And so what I'm eventually going to do, after looking a little bit at the case of N equals 2, is just consider these two things separately, because even before we start, we have a problem understanding the N categories involved, and we have a problem understanding duals. So in the second half of today's talk, I'll just talk about these things in boxes and trying to figure out how they even have an N category structure on them in the first place. And then tomorrow I'll talk about a little bit about understanding duals by themselves and what happens to them in higher dimensions. The more we go on, the more this becomes open questions rather than anything that's actually been done. It's sort of, there's more to say about what hasn't been understood than what has been understood at this point. So remember that the Tangle Hypothesis says that the N category of framed N tangles in N plus K dimensions should be the free K-tuply monoidal N category with duals on one object. And yesterday we did N equals 0, which was just steps with some structure, which stabilized, remember, after a couple of goes, because you have zero manifolds in zero space, and then you have one manifold, zero manifolds in one space, and then you have zero manifolds in two space, at which point you can move all your points around each other. And then from then on down, you can always move all your points around each other in exactly the same way, so you don't get anything different. And that's some evidence for the stabilization hypothesis. And then you move over into the next column along, the N equals 1 column, when you're looking at categories with extra structure. So you start off by having zero manifolds in zero space together with one manifold between them in one space. Not very interesting. And then you do zero manifolds in one space together with one manifold in two space between them. A little bit of stuff, but you don't get to cross anything over each other because you don't have any room in two space. So then you go into three space, and then your one manifolds are in three space, so you get to braid things around each other a bit. And then finally you go up into four space, and then you get that overcrossings and undercrossings have become the same because you can always cross them past each other in four space. And then from that point on, you always get the same thing, because once you're in higher dimensions than that, there's the somebody's embedding theorem, the Whitney embedding theorem, which says that all the embeddings are isotopic to each other. So you don't get anything new, and that's the evidence for the stabilization hypothesis in the N equals 1 case, that you get the braiding that turns into a symmetry, and then it just stays being a symmetry in all the higher dimensions. So then we're going to try and look at the N equals 2 case, where we're going to have not only zero manifolds somewhere and one manifold somewhere, but also two manifolds between them somewhere. And so we have two manifolds like this. It looks quite pretty with the pink. And we didn't have to think very seriously about the cubes when we were doing the previous dimension, because various people have understood tangles anyway. But when we go up into the next dimension, very little had been worked out about anything. And Byers and Langford came along in HDA 4, and they sat down and they worked out a lot of stuff for the case of two tangles in four space. Now, this was helped along by the fact that Carter, Rieger, and Saito had done a huge classification of two tangles, but it's very, very involved. So you classify everything according to various different kinds of catastrophes that can happen in them and where they happen. So they used that, but they also needed to compare it with two tuply monoidal two categories. So that's braided and monoidal two categories. And a satisfactory definition of that in full generality hadn't really appeared. There had been some attempts, there had been some errors. So we'll look at that a little bit. And basically, they didn't do the full generality. They made various simplifications just in order to make it easier, because it's just way too difficult. But first, let's talk a little bit about the simpler case, which is N equals 2 and K equals 1. So let's start with equals 2 and k equals 1. So our zero self, we're looking for some sort of two category with extra structure. So we've got these zero selves which are going to be sitting inside an interval. I shouldn't just put endpoints on here. Right. So there are two things we can do with these. Right. This is supposed to be monoidal, so there's only one thing we can do with it, which we can stick the intervals end to end. So there's a tensor which consists of sticking the intervals end to end. And the reason that it's a tensor and not a composition, except that a tensor is a kind of composition, but there's no source target matching up that has to happen because these points always sit inside the interior of this interval, so there's no question we have to ask about the endpoints matching up. So that's how you stick them together. Of course, if you're we are going to be thinking about doing these actually in unit intervals. So once you've stuck your two unit intervals together, you get an interval that's twice as long as a unit. And so there's some question about what map you're going to use to reparameterize it to get back down to an interval again. Now, secretly we think to ourselves, well, we don't care a huge amount, because if we're going to take some sort of isotropy classes, then all we're going to care about is how many points there are on it. So it didn't really matter how we reparameterize it. But if we're going to take the fully weak n-category structure very seriously, we'll see later that we will care what we use to parameterize it. But that's for later. So one cells are going to be one manifold in two space. And so there's a tensor product which is inherited from the tensor product that we had on the zero cells. So we can tensor things together like this. And again, we'll need to reparameterize sideways like this to get something that's a unit square. But we can also compose end to end. So if this is the one cell direction, right? So we can compose one cell end to end if they match on their source and target. I probably shouldn't draw it here because it's going to be really confusing. Oh well. So if I draw a couple of little ones, something. So we can compose them end to end, and then we reparameterize it and get something like that. And then we have our two cells, which are like this. And then there are three things we can do to these, right? Because we can stack the boxes in any of the directions according to its dimension. So now we have to consider that here's a zero cell, right? This is a two cell coming down here, and this is a two cell coming down here. So where are the one cells? The one cells are in this direction. So here's, well, maybe I should call them in that direction. So here's the zero cell of the source, which hasn't got anything in it. So this one cell is going along there like that, and it's finishing up here. So composing, stacking boxes in this direction is vertical composition of two cells, which I've fortunately drawn to be vertical. Sometimes I get it the wrong way up. I'm like, oh, vertical composition is stacking this way. So this is vertical composition, and horizontal composition of two cells is the one that comes along with ordinary composition of one cells. So that's how you can tell which direction you're going. So ordinary composition of one cell is going to go like this. So for example, I could stick another box on here, like this. With something in it that matches up with this. So we have to have a one cell at the top that matches with this thing. So let's put something here like this. And we've got to have a one cell at the bottom and we've got this two cell coming down. So they match up along here so we can produce the result of that. Which have two holes like this, and what did I do? Oh, I did that, all right. So I'm feeling a bit guilty now because this board doesn't make any sense if you just look at it. So you have to read it dynamically. So this composed with that is that, or this composed with that is that. But there's also the tensor product, right? So the tensor product is what you get along, it's inherited from the direction of tensor producting the zero cells. So when we took this zero cell, just look at this zero cell at the moment, it's a line and it's got two things on it. So we could stick another line on it here with some points on it. So if we, I keep fantasizing about having little pens that just draw in midair, so that you can just draw a line like there and it'll stay there in midair. So you could do this. So then imagine that I've drawn another box that came out of the board like this. And this is, so tensor product is coming out in this direction. So one thing that you'll notice immediately is that I've been a bit vague about why these had to be straight lines coming down the side. And it's a somewhat interesting question that got me all confused when I was listening to Aaron's talk the other day. But I'll talk about that more later. We're just going to demand, in order to make this work and fit into the structure of an N category rather than having more complicated cubical things going on, we're going to demand that nothing interesting happens down there. So in order to join up these points with these points, this is supposed to be a globular category, right? So here's the one category of, here's the one category here, the one cell here, and here's the one cell up here. And when you're in a globular category, you demand that the source and target of this one cell match the source and target of that one cell. So all that condition has told us so far is that these points here have to match with these points here. It hasn't told us that we didn't do something really crazy on this face of the cube in order to join up these points and these points. But if we did something crazy, then we'd end up with a cubical category. So a cubical category is one, broadly speaking, where you're also allowed to have non-trivial morphisms coming down the sides so that you don't just have to have the sources and targets matching up. Now, a cubical category, if all the morphisms down the sides happen to be the identity, then you just get something globular back out again. So what we've done here is we've demanded is basically that everything down the side is the identity, which has forced us into a globular situation. There's a question about whether every cobordism with corners can be represented in this way. That's a completely different question, which I'll talk about some other time. The other thing to observe is that on this front face here, we're not allowed to touch it at all. And the reason we're not allowed to touch it at all was because our zero cells weren't allowed to touch the outside of their interval. And if they weren't allowed to touch the outside of their interval, then nothing else along here is allowed to touch it, because it's got to be the identity. So once there's nothing here, then being the identity all the way along here means that nothing can touch it at all, which means that when you stack things in this direction, there's no source-target matching condition that has to happen. So we can express those conditions abstractly by demanding that there's some product structure near all the boundaries of this cube. And another thing that this helps us with is the fact that when we stick these things together, we want to get something that's still smooth, because it's supposed to be a manifold. And if you happen to arrive at the boundary, a bit like my picture, for example, in a random direction, and this one arrived at the boundary in some random direction, then when you stick them together, you have very little chance of being smooth at the boundary. Whereas if you demand that near this boundary you turned into a product, it's also called having a collar around here. So you demand that there's a little collar around here, that is, that it's completely straight here. So you have a little collar around here that's completely straight, and a little collar around here. That's the same as saying, okay, in this some epsilon region near the boundary, and near this boundary, you had a product structure, so you became completely straight, and then this one was completely straight, and then you just match and everything's fine. And you do that at this boundary as well, because you need to be able to match with whatever you're meeting here in order to get something smooth when you finish up as well. So in general, ensuring that your things are manifolds is a bit tricky, and it just gets trickier and trickier as you go into higher dimensions, of course. Because the other thing that we want to do is we want to do this reparameterizing business. And when we reparameterize, we have to make sure everything stays smooth as well. So we have to be a little bit careful about what forms of reparameterization we use. So that's the idea of putting these things inside boxes, is to have get a handle, that's a bad word, to get a grip on how we're going to technically stick these things together. Because in fact, people are trying to do this much more technically than I'm doing it by waving my arms around at the blackboard. Okay, are there any questions about the way in which this is supposed to form an N category? Okay, good. So I'm not going to say very much more about that dimension because I want to talk about what Byers and Langford did. Langford in HDO4, which is k equals 2, n equals 2. And of course, it becomes even more difficult to draw this because how am I ever going to draw a 2 manifold in 4 space? Sorry? Well, it's supposed to be one tuply monoidal two category, so that's just going to be a monoidal bicategory with duals. So nothing, there isn't really space for anything particularly interesting to happen. So I'm not going to try and draw any two manifolds in four space. The way that they do it is by having what they call movies of these things. So you can imagine it's a bit like one of these things transforming over time, if you imagine that the fourth dimension is time. Don't you get really fed up when non-mathematicians say, yeah, but isn't the fourth dimension time? You sort of go, well, no. Yeah, it is. Yeah, okay. So, but we can treat it as if it were time and then have a series of movies that show us how this thing is transforming in the fourth dimension. And because there are only, we're going to demand that there are only kind of a finite number of catastrophes that happen, we don't have to go on forever with this movie. We can just show the different stages of development as it goes along. And what one thing that Byers and Langford make use of is the fact that we can reduce our work by understanding a smaller class of manifolds that are particularly nicely behaved. So you know eventually you're going to want to take some sort of equivalence classes of these things. So you might as well even stop thinking about some of the really complicated ones if you know that they're going to be equivalent to some simpler version of them. And so they have this notion of a generic tangle, and then there's a theorem saying that any old tangle is equivalent to a generic one. So then when you're thinking about the structure, all you have to think about is the generic ones. So I'm going to... Well, so one thing they do, I'm just going to write a list of sort of points about what they do. So first of all, they only do the unframed case. So in the end, we want to have framed manifolds, but it's too hard. So they only did the unframed. Maybe they only did the... unframed case. They made everything stricter in order to make it simpler. So it's much, they did some semi-strict version. Instead of the fully weak one. So in particular, it means that we can ignore the reparameterizing issue because we're going to take equivalence classes. This amounts to, usually you would only take equivalence classes at the nth level, but they take equivalence classes right from the bottom so that they get a strictly associative composition at all levels, which means that you can ignore this problem of reparameterizing, i.e. take equivalence classes at all dimensions. So what this does is, on the manifold side, it means you can ignore the reparameterization issues. And on the N category side, It means you can ignore various coherence questions. So they're not going to get a braided monoidal bi-category, they're going to get a braided monoidal two-category. So they also restrict to what they call generic tangles. And I'll explain what those are in a minute. But they're basically ones where there aren't too many catastrophic events, and the catastrophic events that are there are spaced out a bit so that you don't have several catastrophes occurring at the same time, because that's too difficult to deal with. Interesting. Features spaced out. And also, to preserve the smoothness when we compose, we have these product structures everywhere. Use collars to preserve smoothness. When you do the composition. So my main aim of explaining any of this is to give a feel for some of the issues that we had to deal with when we tried to make the N category version of this. Okay. So more precisely, what do we do? You kind of go a step at a time. You decide what's going to count as a nice one cell, and then you use it to say what's going to count as a nice two cell. Because a nice two cell has to kind of be a nice one cell at every point where there is a one cell. So when you take its cross sections, they have to be nice in the sense of the one cell version. And then you put in a little extra condition as well. So a generic one tangle is a one manifold in three space such that it's a one manifold with boundary. I don't really mean any old three space, I mean three cube. Such that, well, first of all, the boundary has to be in the right place, right? So the boundary is only allowed to occur at the edges of the cube. So the boundary is entirely in the interior of the top and bottom face. There's a product structure near the top and bottom. So here, when I'm saying top and bottom, I'm meaning in the direction that our one cell is going. Product structure. Near the top and bottom. It's got finitely many crossings. That is to say, if you project it, it's got finitely many crossings. So the crossings are the only things that can be at all interesting. Well, there are two things that can be interesting in a one tangle. You can have a crossing and you can have a critical point. So the critical points we're interested in, so this is our one cell direction. So we've got some kind of tangle that might look a bit like this. Or something. That's not very smooth, is it? And so what you want to know is that if you're interested in the critical points with respect to this last dimension as you're coming down in the direction of your one cell. So the things that are interesting as you move down this box are the critical points and the crossings, and you want them all to occur at different times so that you can separate them out. So you want the critical points with respect to the last coordinate. For a start, you want them to be not too awful. So you want them to be all non-degenerate local extrema. And you want the critical points and crossings all to occur at different heights. So that's what a generic one tangle is. And then one thing that's important is, of course, when you take equivalence classes of these things, you want to make sure that you're going to preserve their genericness and make sure that your equivalences aren't too violent. Now, the first time this was done, they used some equivalence classes that made too many things equivalent, and then the whole thing went wrong. So we want to have, I'm not going to go into very much detail with this because I don't really understand the technicalities, to be honest, but the idea is you want to preserve the levels of these things, because you've got this important question going on about the different heights of these critical points and the crossings. So if you used an isotopy that changed the heights of these things with respect to each other, then you might not preserve that question. And also, the different heights are really important. You can't just change the heights of these things with respect to each other at will, it turns out, inside this structure. So when you take an isotopy class, you don't want to switch the heights of these things. And so that's the technicality of it is something that they call a level-preserving isotopy. So then it's all subject to the following equivalence relation. So this is what I was talking about when I was talking about taking equivalence relations at all levels. We wouldn't expect to take equivalence classes of one cells, but we're going to do it anyway. It's an ambient isotopy. Which is level preserving. And the other thing you want to do is you want to preserve this product structure that you have near the top and the bottom. And in order to do that, you have to make sure your isotopy also has a product structure near the top and the bottom. And so you want to have product bottom. So one cells are going to be equivalence classes of generic one tangles. Are there any questions about that? So you can regard all that as kind of technicalities to make sure that everything joined up properly. So then you have to have a notion of generic two tangle. which also you have to have the boundary in the right place. So it's sort of, it's like this. So the boundary has to be in the right place. You also want the collars. And again, so now you have to imagine that this is actually a four-dimensional cube and that the last dimension is still coming down the page. So we're still going to talk about the last dimension as height. And what we're interested in is the intersection of our tangle with hyperplanes as constant height. And what you want is that all your intersections at constant with hyperplanes of constant height are generic one tangles, apart from finitely many of them, which are allowed to be catastrophic. So if you look at it, in terms of this, what we did was we said, okay, mostly when we take intersections at this level, we're just going to get individual points. Occasionally we get crossings, so sort of things meet with each other, and also at these critical points, the points will get closer and closer and closer and closer and closer, and then they meet each other. So those are the catastrophes at the level below. So at this level, we have intersections with hyperplanes of constant height must all be generic tangles. Except finitely many of them which are allowed to be catastrophes, and Carter, Rieger and Saito classified all possible catastrophes, basically. So there's this list of all the possible catastrophes, and they all have nice names, which I won't list now. But what it's saying is that if it happens to be a different kind of catastrophe from any of those, we could isotope it into one of the classifying ones that they came up with. And this helps us to organize ourselves so that we don't have to consider too many different objects, which must have certain catastrophe forms. Classified by Carter, Rieger and Saito. So that's what a generic two tangle is. And then again, we're going to put an equivalence relation on them, which also says that it's some sort of very careful isotopy, which is a product near the boundaries and which is level preserving. And then we use equivalence relation, a sort of careful Okay, so it's worth noting that when you do the reparameterizing of your boxes after you've stuck them together, not every possible reparameterization will be one of those. But you can always pick a reparameterization which will satisfy all those conditions, which means that sticking boxes together is definitely going to be a strict composition. Stacking boxes is strict. Composition, since we can always pick a reparameterization that gives that preserves
the group that satisfies the necessary conditions. It's a very vague statement. Never mind. Okay.
So once you've done that, the dual structure is just like we did yesterday, except that you have to do it a bit more technically and less visually because we're in four dimensions. But you still just reflect things in the relevant coordinate, and then to find the units and the co-units, you perform a rotation and you sweep out a manifold as you go along. So that's the manifold side, very vaguely. Are there any questions about that? Okay, so what about the N category side, the algebra side? There's some fantastically long definition that they make of braided monoidal two categories with all sorts of interactions between the dual structure and the coherence structure for the two category, a bit like what we saw yesterday. And one of the things that they comment about it is that this is not a tenable way forward. They just go right in there with their hands and just decide what axioms they're going to be, and it's a list of axioms like this, and they sort of say, you know, clearly some better method is required for the general case, because already for n equals 2 and k equals 2 it's really complicated. And anyway, they're not even doing the completely general case, because what their theorem is going to be is that the thing we just constructed, it is the free braided monoidal two category with duals, not on any old object, because we haven't done the framing, right? So it's on an unframed self-dual object. So we saw yesterday that one of the extra things that we imposed was that the double dual was going to be the same as itself. Now, to get rid of the framing, we're going to say that everything dual is the same as itself, because the framing does two things. Remember, it sort of gives us a framing, as in the notion of twisting up our strands, but it also gives us orientation. So we want to get rid of both of those things. And on objects, the orientation is plus or minus. It gives us x, or the dual of x. So what we want to demand, first of all, is that the dual of x is x. So self-dual says that x dual equals x. And to get rid of the framing, remember, the framing was related to the fact that that wasn't the same as this. And so what they say is that we're not going to force those things to be exactly the same, but we're going to specify an isomorphism. Is it a three-cell? No, it's a two-cell isomorphism called the writhing, which has to satisfy an axiom that means that essentially we didn't have any way of twisting these things up. So the axiom says that you could start with a single strand like this, and you could turn it into one of those, because this is the kind of triangulator, right? That's the unit and the co-unit stuck in the triangle form, and so there's a two manifold that does this. I can't draw it anymore. What's happened? Oh, it's supposed to go. There's supposed to be a thing like this, isn't there? It's sort of like this. And that's supposed to be something like that. So there's a two manifold that goes in between these two things. And then we can isolate this part of it and do a writhing on it. So we go up here like this, and then instead of having that, we put in our writhing. And then we can straighten ourselves out a bit to make that. So remember that this was one of the critical things that happened in the previous dimension. We looked at that and said, well, this gives us an extra piece of data. So I feel like this isn't a very systematic approach, but it's related to what Nick was saying in his talk about making the axioms for tricategories. You're sort of looking for the things that gave you interesting structure at the level below, and then you're taking them really seriously when you go to the level above. So the other thing you could do is, instead of doing your unit data that way around, you could have done it the other way around, like that. And then you can look at these parallel parts of the strands, and you can do a braiding and an unbraiding very fast in there. So you can do a braiding and then an unbraiding, which looks a bit futile at this point. But what you can then do here is you can do an upside down writhing. So you've still got your braiding at the top, but then you do an upside down writhing, which basically gives you that. And then you can straighten yourself up a bit, and you turn to that. This one? This one? No, it's really a braiding and an unbraiding. I'm not trying to twist them up, because right, if you do a braiding and a braiding, that's not going to be the same as the identity. So this is the condition on the writhing.
Even the braiding and the unbraiding are the same thing.
No, it's not, but there is a cell. There's a braiding unbraidingator that's a bit difficult to draw, but it's going to go to here, so it's sort of in four space this works a bit better, I guess. So this is what they're using to tell us that this thing is really unframed. Right. So evidently everything has become really hard. Yeah. Oh, sorry, this is what it means to be an unframed object. Yeah. A in an object A is unframed if equipped with this writhing, which is WA, such that that commutes. Yep. Because what exhibits some extra strictness? Oh, yeah. The fact that it's a braided monoidal two-category rather than this is a strict two-category, in the sense of strict two-category rather than bi-category, yeah, that's something that they've built in. So the general thing would be much harder. So being a strict two-category also greatly simplifies how we define the duals, because we don't have to insert associators and left and right units all over the place. So the notion, we have a notion of a dual for an object in a strict two-category. You have your units as usual, and then you have, instead of the triangle identities, you have these triangulator things, which are the swallowtail and the other thing. But if it were a weak one, then there'd be all sorts of more stuff that you'd have to do inside there. Which monoidal functor? Oh, in terms of the... Everything's very strict.
A two functor, reciprocity of difficulty, right? The pseudo functors from strict categories are kind of like the same as strict functors from pseudo categories.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? That's
okay. Well, I mean, I feel we should go and get coffee for a second now, anyway, and recover from this and then think about N categories. We're going to forget about the whole dual situation, and we're going to just see if we can figure out a way of saying that these things in boxes are N categories at all. And this is answering one of the questions that starts this whole thing off, which is that there are lots of examples of, there are lots of definitions of N category and not very many actual examples of N categories. And so Nick and I one day sat down and just decided we were going to try and do anything. Something. Anything. And because these boxes, it looks like it's really obvious what you want to do, right? You have these boxes. If they're in K dimensions, you can stack them in K ways and then you reparameterize them. And surely the different ways of reparameterizing them in different directions, surely that's coherent in some sense. It just must be. So we just tried to make a definition that said that. And it seemed that Trimble's definition was going to be just right for doing this. Once we stopped going backwards, we keep getting these left and right things mixed up. But Trimble's definition uses reparameterizing and takes it very seriously of N category. And his definition was set up very specifically with the idea of doing fundamental N-groupoids in mind. And when you do fundamental N-groupoids, what you do is like that. You're taking a map from I into a space, which is your path, and then when you want to compose them together, you've got two maps like this. So you take co-products of them, which gives you a map from I plus I into X, but oh dear, that's I plus I, and what we want is our path is mapped from I into X. So then you stick a map from I into I plus I on the end, and that turns you, that's your what I'm calling a reparameterizing map. It turns you back into a thing from I into X. And so what it says is that we're going to remember what the reparameterizing thing is that we did. Instead of just saying that there is one composite given any composable pair of things, we're going to say that there's one composite for every reparameterizing map that there could possibly be. So we remember what those are. And the point is that the reparameterizing maps are pretty well understood. They form a topological operand. And it, moreover, it's a contractible thing. And the contractibility encodes a lot of nice coherence so that you can separate out that part and say, well, it's contractible. There are all these contractible spaces of maps like that. And that's what's going to tell us that the whole thing is coherent. Then we don't have to say it. We don't have to say it piece by piece because it's gone into the contractibility of this space. So, the idea is that we're going to use maps from the unit interval, which I write like that, to the length k interval to reparameterize our cubes, but abstractly we're just going to use them to parameterize composition. So how does this work? Yeah. So k equals 0 to k. So Trimble uses endpoint preserving continuous maps. We're going to see that we're going to have to put more restrictions on those maps in order to preserve all the structure that we wanted to preserve, just in the way that the isotopies had to do it as well. So how does composition work? In general, you start with, say, a string of one cells that you want to compose. F1, F2, up to Fk, so that's going to be Xk. If you were an ordinary category, there's just one composite of those things. But in the one we're going to do, we're going to start with that together with a map, and a map from 1 to k. And it's this piece of data which provides you with a composite. So composing gives something which we could call the composite Fk composed all the way up to F1 sub alpha, if this map is called alpha. So it gives you exactly one composite. So you can sort of think of this, it's still algebraic because it's still a completely determined composite, but it's not algebraic if you're just looking at this string of composites. It's algebraic once you're taking a map in as part of your data as well. Oh, I hate this middle. So then on the two cells, for two cells, you can start with a whole load of F along the top and a whole load of G's and you've got your two cells in between them, beta 1, beta 2, beta 3, and what you're going to have is a map from 1 to k that's parameterizing the top part of the composition, and a map from 1 to k that's parameterizing the bottom. maybe I should have called these, never mind. And you're going to have a homotopy between them, which I will call beta. And that is the data that you have to start with in order to do a two-cell, horizontal two-cell composition. And so what that gives you is a two-cell from the composite at the top with respect to alpha to the composite at the bottom with respect to alpha primed. And so if you want, you can call this the composite of all those things horizontally with respect to beta. That wasn't very legible. So then you keep going to do three cells. You'd have three cells in between all of these and an alpha at the top and an alpha primed at the bottom, and then betas for the source and target side of your thing, and then you'd have a homotopy in between them for the part in between. Yeah? Well, probably, but that relationship hasn't been worked out. It's a bit curious because Batanin's definition, yes, this is also an operatic one, but Batanin's one, for start, this one is enriched. So you go up dimension by dimension, whereas Batanin's one does it all at once. And this one sort of indexes the operand by width, whereas Batanin's one doesn't index it by width, it indexes it by everything. So it's the same sort of idea, but it's subtly different, and that it's an interesting question to see how this thing, there's a way of unfolding, sort of unlooping this to try and make it into a Batanin-like operand, but getting an actual relationship is quite hard. So then you use, so the features of this are, it's enriched. So you can only do n categories once you've done n minus 1 categories. So what you say is that an n category is given by a set of objects for all pairs of objects a HOM n minus 1 category. So you have to know what HOM, you have to know what n minus 1 categories are already. An n category A, and then you have to have a composition n minus 1 functor which goes from, now this is where it gets quite interesting, you've got these maps from 1 to k and they form an operad. So there's an operad. There's a topological operad. Whose kth space is given by the maps, the space of maps from 1 to k, continuous endpoint preserving maps from 1 to k. And you want to use that, but if you're going to have a composition n minus 1 functor, you think it's going to have to go from an n minus 1 category to some n minus 1 category. And what we've got here is a space. So what he does is he takes the fundamental n minus 1 groupoid of this space. So you're parameterizing composition by this. So you have your string of things that you want to compose. AK minus 1, AK, A0 to A1. So this is saying, given any string of things you want to compose and something in that space, you produce a cell from A0 to AK. Now, because this is an n minus 1 functor, it deals with all the higher dimensions as well. So on objects of these HOM n minus 1 categories, it gives you composition of 1 cells. And then on 1 cells, it gives you composition of 2 cells using the two cells of this fundamental n minus 1 groupoid, which is the homotopies between those maps, and then on the three cells and everything and so on. And then the functoriality of it takes care of various things. You also have to demand that it interacts well with the operad structure here. That takes care of some more coherence. And then the fact that this is contractible takes care of some more coherence, because what it tells you is, given any two different ways you chose of reparameterizing, there definitely is a way of getting in between them, because we know that given any two maps from 1 to k, there's a homotopy between them. And so the contractibility of this space gives you all the coherent stuff. So it's very, very neat and tidy interacting. So this has to interact well with the operad structure. Of course, I haven't told you how to take the fundamental n minus 1 category of this thing. It's the fundamental n minus 1 groupoid as an n minus 1 category according to this definition. But that's a whole different story. But it's quite interesting. It's really not very hard. So I could talk about this definition for way too long because it's really interesting. So I'll try not to do that. And instead I'll try and say, how does this help us? What does it do for us? So as a warm-up, we started thinking, yeah. Oh, it's all right, I didn't say it. That's why you missed it. Yeah, he has. It takes about this much space. So the whole definition takes about that much space. It's quite neat. I mean, I can tell you about it quite quickly over coffee later if you're interested. So what we started by looking at is just trying to apply this definition to subsets of cubes. A manifold embedded in a cube is a subset of a cube. It's an awfully nicely behaved one with all sorts of conditions, which we're going to worry about checking later. But fundamentally, we should be able to just do it on subsets of cubes at all. So as a warm-up exercise, try it on subsets of cubes. So the key here is to regard a subset of a cube. I also write 1 as I because I get bored of writing 1 in brackets sometimes. You use a characteristic function and you write your subset of a cube like that. So in the one-dimensional case, if you're just doing what? This is a two-element set. Sorry, I didn't say anything like that. So it's a two-element set. So for example, for subsets of I, the interval, you can express those as just a map from the interval to the two-element set, which just tells you, given any point, whether it's in your subset or not. And then you can compose them, right? Because what you can say is, if you've got this subset, So these subsets could look really bizarre at this point. They could sort of look like this with all sorts of weird stuff going on. But if you have several of them, x1, x2, say, up to xk, then what you've actually got is some map from I to 2, right? And now we can take a co-product of them, or possibly a co-limit. We have to identify the ends of it. So we can now get an x1 plus xk, which goes, well, it goes from the k-length interval now to 2. And now, if we're given some reparameterizing map, so given alpha from I to k, because this is now not a subset of the unit interval, it's a subset of the k-length interval. We've literally stuck them together. So now we can just compose it. So what does it tell us if we try and do this on two cubes? Okay. So let's say we're trying to do horizontal composition of two boxes. So what does that tell us? It says, given some two cells, let's call them x1 to y1, x2 to y2, and so on, up to xk to yk, theta 1, theta 2, up to theta k, and a homotopy. So what are these? These are all maps from I cross I to 2, right? They're all characteristic functions. And a homotopy alpha so we've got alpha going from F to G. So F and G are both going to be maps from 1 to k. So we've got a homotopy between them. Well, what's a homotopy between them? It's something from I cross I to k, such that alpha of 0 blank is f, and alpha of 1 blank is g. So what it tells us is that we've got, for every height, we've got to think of one of these coordinates as the horizontal one, and one of them as the height. So at every height, we have a reparameterization. And at the top, the reparameterization is f, the one we're going to use on the top. And at the bottom, the reparameterization is g. And we're just going to gradually reparameterize our thing all the way down according to the t reparameterizing map that this gives us. Yeah. 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 So to interpret this as a picture, we've got these boxes, right? And we've stuck them together. This is x1 going to y1, x2 going to y2. And this is xk going to yk, and each one is some sort of weird subset that's goodness knows what. At the moment, it could be any sort of crazy thing. And so at each height along here, at height t, we're going to reparameterize it by alpha of t blank. Did I do that the right way around? Yeah. So you can write down a formula that does that for you. And of course, that's horizontal composition. So remember, horizontal composition means it's the one that came along with the one cell composition. If we're considering the subsets of one cubes to be one cell composition, then this is in the direction of one cell composition. Now, if we did it, if we did vertical composition, we would just be reparameterizing vertically. And what we'd be doing, we'd only have one reparameterizer, because this would be inside the HOM category. Right? So we'd have one reparameterizer, and we would do the entire thing kind of in parallel, squashing it this way. So squashing it this way, vertically and horizontally, is very different. Because in this direction, at each height, you do a different reparameterization. So it's sort of, you can move things around a bit, but only on level. You can't mix things up. You can just squish them a bit differently on a level. Whereas when you're doing it vertically, you know, if you stood on your side, you might think to yourself, this is just like doing it side by side, but it's not, because you're going to do everything all at the same speed this way around. So you can do three cubes in the same way, and what this tells us is that in each direction you have a way of reparameterizing, but it's going to be more complicated as you move up your directions. So your three cube has a kind of one cell composition direction, a two cell composition direction, and a three cell composition direction. And when you're doing the horizontal composition, you can do all sorts of different things as you go along, because you've got a homotopy between things. On your two-cell direction, you've just got a homotopy between homotopies, so each plane is going to go in the same way. And then when you're doing the three-cell composition, the whole thing is going to happen in very parallel. Right, are there any questions about that? Yeah? Oh no, you could do more than that if you wanted, yeah. So this should give us some kind of N category of subsets of boxes. And this is all very well, but it's a bit complicated, because when you get to N, you have to take an equivalence relation. And we have no idea what this equivalence relation gives us on subsets of boxes. We figured out a few conditions it would have to give, but in the end, we have absolutely no idea, because it's just a bit crazy. So the question is, can we apply this to manifolds and get something sensible for manifolds? So, well, the problem is that now we have to restrict. We don't want to use all possible endpoint preserving continuous maps as reparameterizations, because some of them will break the smoothness of our manifolds. Either, when we reparameterize, you could just become unsmooth. You could also make something really different that you didn't want it to be. If your map went back on itself or something, you can just make something really weird. So if you could start with something like this and reparameterize yourself in a really sort of going backwards and forwards way, and you could end up with that, for example. We don't want that. So we have to restrict ourselves. But Trimble's definition doesn't really allow us to have very much control on how we restrict ourselves. Because actually what we want to do at this point is we want to take a subgroupoid of the fundamental N groupoid. We don't want to take the entire thing. Now, the first thing you might think of doing, or at least the first thing we thought of doing, was to take a suboperand and start with a suboperand here. But that doesn't work, because you want to take a subset of cells at every single dimension. And it's very difficult to find, so this is the question, is there a space whose fundamental N groupoid is the sub N groupoid that we want? And that's really hard, because once you've change the points of your space. Okay, we can change the points of our space to be anything we want. We can say we only want smooth continuous endpoint preserving maps with a product structure near the ends, blah blah blah. But then what do we do about the higher homotopies? We can't suddenly throw away some higher homotopies because once we fix the points of the space, that's it, we're done. So instead, we have to do something about the definition here and take some sub-fundamental N groupoid here. So the problem is, want to restrict pi n minus 1 of ek at every dimension. Because we take these smooth, continuous, endpoint preserving maps with a product structure near the end, and then we only want the kind of smooth homotopies between them, if that means anything, that are sort of have product structures near the end, such that at every time t, the thing you get between them is an example of the lower dimension thing, so at each dimension. And then what's even worse is that you want to make it into an operad. So operadic composition has to preserve all the properties that we demanded in the first place. So then you have to impose a whole lot more conditions on it. So we can't find a subspace E primed of EK whose fundamental N groupoid is the one we want. So that didn't work. So instead, we said, well, you know, the thing that we were interested in was, in fact, an operad in n minus 1 categories. Because what this pi n minus 1 has done is turned our operad in spaces into an operad in n minus 1 categories. And there was no particular reason to start with an operad in spaces. It was just nice because it was well behaved. So we could make a definition of n category that says, start with an operad in n minus 1 categories. Now, that's a bit unfortunate because one of the whole nice things about this was we didn't have to take a new operad at every dimension. We just took one operad that was sort of infinite dimensional and then we quotiented it out at each dimension. So instead what we ended up doing was saying we want an operad in globular sets. So this starts getting closer and closer to looking like it might be something to do with Pitanin's definition, but it still isn't quite the same because of this indexing business. So at this point, it's become far too technical, and it's 5 o'clock. But suffice to say, it got really complicated. So what we did was we said you should take an operad in globular sets. But of course, how can you take a fundamental n groupoid of a globular set? That doesn't really make any sense. So then it had to be a globular set that had some kind of action on itself. Because the crucial thing about this is the action that it has on path spaces, on reparameterizing path spaces. So there was all this quagmire stuff. We did it. It's not very pretty, but we did something, and that was our goal at the beginning, was to do something. So we have done something. It's not very pretty. It's worth noting, possibly, that the omega dimensional situation should be easier to describe. So when we were looking at the subsets of boxes, we thought that we had a whole description of it. The only thing we didn't know was what the equivalence classes would actually give us. Of course, if you're going to do omega, you never have to take equivalence classes. You just keep going forever. So that should just be exactly what it is, which should maybe be an extremely stupid but fundamental sort of omega category that's out there. I'll talk more tomorrow about what happens if you don't do n but just keep going to omega and see if that can actually make your life any simpler in places. And I think I'll stop at that point. Are there any questions about this? You're just grinning. You don't have a question. You look like you're about to have a question. Hmm. Well, this is a slightly interesting point. In dimension two, it's fine. It's got lots more stuff. It looks much more like an unbiased bicategory, but it has even more stuff than that. So it hasn't been entirely worked out in what sense it's equivalent to the usual definition, but there should be some up-to-homotopy way of doing it. You can certainly produce yourself a classical bicategory from a Trimble one. For three, it gets a bit interesting because when you do this composition n minus 1 functor, it's a strict functor. So it looks a little bit too strict. Now, it's also not quite so strict, because you have so much stuff going on, you have so many different kinds of composite, it's possible that you could, I mean, I worked out recently something really bizarre, which is that you can get a functor to three categories. Let's see, what am I trying to do? You can get a functor, when you're doing the bicategories, the key is that it looks like your functors of bicategories are strict functors instead of weak functors. And if you ever enrich using strict functors instead of weak functors, you're going to get interchange, which is too strict at the level above. So I had a look at this and got a functor from Trimble two categories to bicategories with weak functors that was surjective on functors, but not locally surjective. So I think this is something that's been confusing me for ages, and I finally worked out what it is, and which is that. So you can get every functor. It's just you have to change your categories a bit. It's to do with which composites you pick to represent your big space of composites. The other interesting thing about it is that it's set up precisely to do fundamental n-groupoids. So Trimble never suggested that this was supposed to be a good general definition of n-category. He was just trying to do something that would do fundamental n-groupoids in a very natural way, which it does. You get to define the fundamental n-groupoid in about this much space. And so sometimes people get really confused about this because they say, but wait, interchange is too strict, so it can't be right. But in fact, if you do fundamental n-groupoids, you do get a strict interchange out. And this confuses people because we know that you need some sort of weak braiding possibility in order to get your three types right. But that braiding comes out of the units. It comes out of the fact that the units are still weak even though the interchange isn't, which is to do with what I was saying on the first day, that the braiding comes from both interchange and the units. So even though interchange is strict, the units aren't, so you can still get all your homotopy types out. Yeah?
So the aggression on the homotopy is positive,
no, it hasn't.
Not even just for the long one.